Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the August 25th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is Did Racial Capitalism Set the Bronx on Fire? By David Immerwahr. A critic at large, did racial capitalism set the Bronx on fire? To some, the fires lit in New York in the late 70s signaled rampant criminality, to others rebellion, but maybe they were signs of something else entirely. By Daniel Immerwahr. Sometimes people say exactly the right thing, other times they don't, and we just pretend that they did. When 18th century Parisians clamored for bread, did Marie Antoinette respond, "Let them eat cake"? No, but the line captures the aristocracy's witlessness. Patrick Henry probably never said, "Give me liberty or give me death," either. The second game of the 1977 World Series at Yankee Stadium provided another such occasion. It was a time of crushing austerity for New York City. Tens of thousands of municipal employees had been laid off, including firefighters. These woes were background to the game, but they flashed into the foreground when a fire in an abandoned elementary school lit up the skies just blocks away. "Ladies and gentlemen," the announcer Howard Cosell famously but never actually said, "the Bronx is burning." Indeed it was. It seemed like just every second there was a fire. Darney, Caborn, Rivers, a local rapper, later recalled, "I'm talking about every block you went on." Families kept suitcases by the door. Children were told to wear shoes to bed. To some, this was a tragic turn in the country's racial drama. White people left cities for the suburbs, taking jobs and tax revenues with them. Black people, trapped in neighborhoods that felt increasingly like holding pens, revolted. The Watts Uprising of 1965 in Los Angeles incinerated hundreds of buildings. The fires continued. The historian Elizabeth Hinton in America on Fire, 2021, counts 1,949 urban insurgencies between May 1968 and December 1972. Those uprisings subsided in the early 70s, yet the fires kept going. Bill Moyers, Lyndon B. Johnson's press secretary, made an award-winning documentary, The Fire Next Door, 1977, about Black and Puerto Rican neighborhoods in the South Bronx. "Burning buildings are as common here as broken dreams," he intoned. The arsonists he highlighted included addicts, welfare cheats, and kids setting fires just for the hell of it. This was, Moyers felt, a society out of control. This was an unfair characterization. The South Bronx was also a fount of artistic fecundity, where poets, musicians, artists, and dancers created hip-hop. The art grew amid the fires, a boisterous eruption of life in deadly surroundings. "Throw your hands in the air and wave them like you just don't care," rock master Scott and the Dynamite Three instructed. Yet fire singed even that carefree party anthem, which ended with an ominous chant, "The roof, the roof, the roof is on fire. We don't need no water, let the motherfucker burn." Conservatives saw this all as the devolution of post-Watts rioting into utter lawlessness. But was that diagnosis right? The South Bronx, the arson capital, hadn't seen much upheaval, and although urban unrest had often burst forth from public housing developments, the projects in the Bronx were virtually flameproof. As a report from the Bronx District Attorney's Office observed, the New York City Housing Authority provided residences for 169,663 families as of January 1977, yet saw an almost total absence of fires. The Bronx firestorm was selective not just in which buildings burned, but in how they did so. The typical Bronx walk-up was built of brick and concrete. A fire might not do much damage unless it burned the roof, in which case water would total the building. Rockmaster Scott and the Dynamic Three proved to be keen students of pyrodynamics, because it was often the roof that caught fire. It was as if someone were trying to do as much damage as possible to privately owned, but not publicly owned, rental properties. In the community, we knew that landlords were burning their buildings, the educator Vivian Vasquez Irazi has said. This was an open secret, reported at the time and arising even in Moyer's documentary. It made little dent on public consciousness, though. When I first moved to New York, the writer Ian Fraser remembers, I assumed, as many people did, that the poverty and fires in the Bronx were just the way the Bronx was. In 2018, Vasquez and Gretchen Hildebrand released a documentary, Decade of Fire, that exonerated the Bronx. Now a historian who worked on that documentary, Bench Ansfield, has published a formidable book, Born in Flames, Norton. The fires were set not by unruly tenants, Ansfield charges, but by landlords seeking insurance payouts. The late 20th century gave rise to a horrifying dynamic throughout the country, but especially in the South Bronx, whereby owners had reason to burn their buildings and few people in power had reason to care. The thought of cities burning in a racial reckoning has long haunted the American imagination. The era of slavery was also the age of wood, and nearly every major slave rebellion and conspiracy involved arson. In one of the most fearsome plots, the Denmark-Vesey conspiracy of 1822, rebels allegedly planned to burn down Charleston. It was easy to understand why slaves might torch cities. But the fires emerging in the mid-60s, just as the civil rights movement was racking up victories, were harder to interpret. Were they protests? Meltdowns? Crimes? As arson and violence convulsed black neighborhoods, white support for the movement plummeted. To conservatives, this was vindication. In an influential essay, Looting and Liberal Racism, 1977, Midge Dechter argued that New York's racial liberalism had done nothing for black and brown people other than convince them that there were virtually no crimes for which they'd be held accountable. Riots fed law and order conservatism. Of course, there were other views. This ain't no riot, brother, this is a rebellion, the black power activist H. Rapp Brown declared in Cambridge, Maryland in 1967. Which is to say, the people in the streets weren't riffraff running amok, but activists with aims. The problem was white violence, Brown explained, and if it didn't stop, black people should burn this town down. About an hour after Brown made that speech, as if to prove his point, police shot him. He lived. Historians have come around to his view. Gerald Horn's The Fire This Time, 1995, Peter B. Levy's The Great Uprising, 2018, Hinton's America on Fire, and most recently Ashley Howard's Midwest Unrest, treat the tumult as a purposeful, even admirable, revolt against racism. Yet these histories focus on the uprisings that wound down by 1972, not on the harder-to-explain fires that followed. Hinton, in another book, briefly connects the Bronx fires to black revolts. Both stem from excessive policing and incarceration, she says, but leaves it there. Ansfield offers a tidier solution. The fires of 1964 to 72 constituted an uprising, yes, but not the subsequent fires. Those were neither riot nor rebellion, but something else, racial capitalism. The term racial capitalism entered American discourse in 1983, via the political scientist Cedric Robinson's Black Marxism, but came into vogue with the Black Lives Matter movement. The idea is that racial oppression is essential to capitalism. So to take a stark but characteristic example from the historian Walter Johnson, Britain's Industrial Revolution was founded upon the capacity of enslaved women's bodies to maintain the supply of black labor. Rape and forced family separation weren't unfortunate byproducts, but elementary aspects of the system. This grim structure has varied with time, yet its fundamentals, economic predation, white supremacy, remain intact. The temporality of racial capitalism, the historians Destin Jenkins and Justin Leroy write, is one of ongoingness. Ansfield brings this expansive vision to the Bronx, following the trail from the arsonists who who did the torching, to the landlords who ordered it, the policymakers who enabled it, the financiers who encouraged it, and the insurers who paid for it. The Bronx's fire-prone tenements were dirt cheap, yet wealthy investors in several countries held stakes in them. The pattern is familiar, Ansfield notes. Once, ships had carried slaves across the Atlantic as part of a triangular trade in captives and commodities that connected the international elite to sadistic violence in Africa and the Americas. In the 1970s, insurance policies that encouraged arson were resold in Miami, London, and Rio de Janeiro. This was the 20th century triangular trade and risk, Ansfield writes, a deadly commerce that was just as legal as the 18th century trafficking in human cargo. When Ansfield filed their dissertation on this topic in 2021, the response was rapturous. Prizes were heaped at their feet. Best dissertation in American Studies and American History at Yale, Co. 1, and so on. Reading their book, which is even sharper, you can see why. It's a deft, at times, brilliant history. To the conservative line about riot-torn cities, it responds firmly. Property owners, not their tenants, were the lawless ones. The Bronx was burned by the lethal alchemy of race and capitalism. The immolation of the Bronx was all the more staggering because, a generation before, it had been filled with upwardly mobile residents and sturdy homes. Colin Powell, who was raised in the South Bronx by Jamaican parents, remembered his neighborhood's intact and secure families and its rough-edged racial tolerance among Jews, Italians, Poles, Greeks, Puerto Ricans, and Blacks. Yet the post-war suburbs drained the borough. The South Bronx, in particular, lost more than 60% of its population between 1950 and 1980. Ansfield shows how the insurance industry hastened the Bronx's decline. As the nationwide uprising began, insurers pulled out of so-called riot-prone areas. Because uninsurable buildings were hard to sell, property values collapsed. Between 1969 and 1979, the Bronx lost 40% of its manufacturing jobs, partly because firms couldn't secure insurance. Landlords floundered too. The Times reported on the desperate owner of a tenement in nearby Inwood who offered to transfer its titles to its tenants for a dollar. None took the deal. Many underwater landlords gave up. They extracted whatever rent they could as they cut services, stopped paying property taxes, and abandoned their buildings. To staunch the bleeding, Congress in 1968 created a form of last-ditch insurance, fair access to insurance requirements plans. Private insurers would be obliged to offer policies that couldn't discriminate by neighborhood. In return, they would be reinsured by the federal government against riots. Fair plan policies were neither cheap nor comprehensive, but when New York started offering them, demand was overwhelming. That should have sounded alarms. The fair plans inadvertently replaced the too little insurance problem with a too much insurance one. Once insurers lost the ability to say no, landlords had little incentive to maintain their properties. If property values dropped, they could drive their buildings into the ground and cash out by arson. The more they did so, the further property values plunged and the more enticing the practice became. Owners often outsourced the arson to cash-strapped locals. Ansfield gives the example of a 15-year-old, Hector Rivera, not his real name, who set 40 to 50 fires. "I don't do it for fun," Rivera explained to a reporter. "I do it when they hire me." He made between $3 and $15 a fire. Occasionally, landlords did their own dirty work. In 1975, Imre Oberlander was arrested while en route to a building he owned with firearms and wearing blackface. He pleaded guilty to weapons possession and served 5 years probation. Oberlander had taken in $125,000 from 21 fires in just 5 years. Another property owner, the convicted felon Joe Bald, was caught leading a ring of landlords who had reportedly collected around $5 million on some 250 burned buildings. A recent study by Ingrid Gould Ellen Daniel Hartley, Jeffrey Lynn, and Wei Yu estimates that in 1978 alone, the state of New York had 13,000 more fires than it would have had without the FAIR plan. Most other states had FAIR plans too, and arsonists torched poor neighborhoods nationwide. Insurers seemed oddly tolerant of this. Litigating claims was costly, the FAIR plans spread out the pain among firms, and historically high interest rates allowed them to offset risks by investing premiums. Interest rates rose so high that out-of-state insurers started voluntarily underwriting Bronx tenements in the midst of the fires, no FAIR plan needed. Still, no matter how you slice it, selling fire insurance to arsonists is a terrible business model. It persisted, Ansfield explains, only because the market was opaque. As with more recent subprime mortgages, brokers sold, bundled, and resold crummy contracts so many times that the people left holding the bag had no clue what was in it. The losses on the policies held by Joe Bald's group wound through a labyrinthine chain of intermediaries before arriving at the storied insurer, Lloyd's of London. Investors there were stupefied, and it was years before they grasped the extent of their exposure. Politicians were no quicker to respond. The indefatigable activist Genevieve Brooks, later Brown, pressed the issue yet found that no one was interested. It took years to win over even a few officials to the cause. One, the Bronx District Attorney Mario Merola, was initially dismissive but became an anti-arson crusader in 1975, Ansfield writes. As he bluntly told the Senate, a substantial portion of his borough's arson was committed for profit. Ansfield also praises the Arson Strike Force, initially the Arson Task Force, as a bona fide white-collar crime squad. Its deputy director, Michael Jacobson, would co-author an article, Burning the Bronx for Profit, that laid bare the evidence. Yet evidence mattered only so much. Just as financial opacity concealed the fires from insurers, racial opacity concealed them from politicians. Gerald Ford, who was president during the peak of the arson wave, publicly mentioned the Bronx just once to go by the American Presidency Project, and that was to commend Merola's office for locking up recidivists. Meanwhile, fire-setting landlords enjoyed extraordinary immunity from prosecution, immunity from blame, even. Most people found it easier to chalk up the conflagration to ghetto anarchy. Vivian Vasquez Irazi laments, "That's the only story that ever gets told," to the point that inhabitants of the Bronx now believe it themselves. Ansfield agrees. The vague impression that Bronxites burned down their own borough and doors while the vast fortunes made were forgotten. Ansfield's great achievement is following the money, the thread linking the fortunes to the fires. This is the panoramic, all its connected view that racial capitalism theory promises. One thinks of Walter Johnson's insistence that the mills in Manchester depended on the rape of women in Mississippi. That story works best, though, if the fires were all set for insurance. Were they? Other histories, Bill Jones's South Bronx Rising, Evelyn Gonzalez's The Bronx, Jonathan Mahler's Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, Joe Flood's The Fires, and Ian Fraser's Paradise Bronx identify multiple culprits. Landlords torch properties, everyone agrees, but renters did too. New York City paid up to $2,000 to arson victims who had lost their furniture and clothing and put them at the head of the line for hard-to-get public housing. Firemen spoke of seeing tenants sitting outside flaming buildings with their belongings neatly arranged beside them. Furthermore, scavengers used fires to destroy walls and steal fixtures and fittings. Perhaps a few tenants, furious at paying rent they couldn't afford for services they weren't getting, lit fires to strike back. We don't need no water, let the motherfucker burn. Ansfield discusses these phenomena with admirable sensitivity, yet warns against overstating their significance. Burning to get public housing was minimal. Welfare arsonists and building strippers were scapegoats. Elizabeth Hinton has claimed that the inhabitants of the Bronx lit more fires than their landlords did. Ansfield, having none of it, scolds Hinton for her unsound verdict. We don't actually know who lit more fires, but Ansfield's contention that the fires were primarily landlord-set diverges from most judgments at the time, including those of insurance fraud's fiercest critics. Marola, the Bronx district attorney, campaigned energetically against landlords. Yet when asked what proportion of arsonists they committed, he guessed about 20%. Michael Jacobson of the Arson Strike Force was unyielding in exposing arson insurance arson. He now teaches at the SUNY Graduate Center, and I asked him how much arson in the Bronx had been for profit. 30 to 40%, he estimated. But he specified this included cases where landlords ordered fires and those where they merely abandoned their buildings, leaving tenants, thieves, or others to light the match. The landlords collected, Genevieve Brooks insisted in oral history. Ansfield quotes that line, but not what she said next, which is that the building strippers did too. Everybody profited, Brooks observed. Similarly, Ansfield twice quotes Hector Rivera, the 15-year-old arsonist, explaining that he sets fires because they hire me. Ansfield implies that Rivera worked for landlords, ignoring his specification that they were thieves stealing plumbing, fixtures, and hardware. As with everything in the city, there were small-time plays and big-time scams, the New York novelist Colson Whitehead writes, in reference to the arson epidemic in Crook Manifesto, 2023. People setting fires every night, a character observes, had not just guys in it for the insurance. These multi-causal explanations soften the accusatory focus on landlords but pull the lives of tenants into sharper detail. As the South Bronx's private housing market collapsed, many owners compensated for lost rents by retracting services. Shivering, tenants used ovens and electric heaters for warmth, which, especially in buildings with old wiring, caused fires. As the deteriorating tenements emptied, the arsons began. Landlords burned to get insurance, scavengers to access metal, and tenants to escape the doomed buildings for safer, better maintained, and subsidized public housing. Fire was contagious. Tenants expecting their homes to burn had reason to light the fires themselves, to control when they happened, and thus protect their lives and property. Michael Jacobson interviewed convicted New York arsonists for his dissertation. Some burned for pay, some not. What united them was their highly stressful lives. Most had quarreled with someone right before the act. Unfortunately, fires, by ripping households and neighborhoods apart, only compounded the stress. And surely the more fires that raged, the easier it was to imagine using arson to rob apartments, hurt competitors, or get revenge. The deadliest fire at the Puerto Rican Social Club was orchestrated by a man motivated by jealousy. In the Holocaust of the South Bronx, lighting a match could seem just like hastening the inevitable. Emphasizing arson's complex motives is no defense of the system. Even fires set by vandals were shaped by a larger political economy, which included banks, landlords, and insurance companies, Jacobson writes. Still, the relation between finances and fire was often indirect. Poverty has the power to make perpetrators of its victims, and Bronxites feared their neighbors as well as their landlords. The thread tangles at the other end, too. Ansfield describes vast fortunes made from insurance arson. Yet claims rarely exceeded $30,000, and the Bronx's swiftly depreciating tenements were generally owned by petty and mid-tier operators, not Tom Wolfe-style masters of the universe. Joe Bald, the leader of the arson ring, had been an interior decorator, a furniture dealer, and a rabbi. There were fires that benefited Wall Street. The historian Dylan Gottlieb has explained how Hoboken property owners torched hundreds of inhabited tenements and rooming houses to clear space for yuppies' luxury apartments. The Bronx fires, however, were a drain on the financial elite. Insurance arson wasn't the richest squeezing the poorest. It was hustlers, slumlords, corrupt brokers, tough guys, owners in dire straits, defrauding large corporations. The poor were collateral damage. Racial capitalism theorists, emphasizing systematicity tend to see historical traumas as features, not bugs. They envisage a vast extractive structure in which, as Walter Johnson writes, white supremacy justified the terms of imperial disposition and capitalist exploitation. But the Bronx had high unemployment, low property values, and large welfare rolls. How much was there to extract? Bronxites were less exploited by capitalists than mauled by an unexpected combination of policies and incentives that few outsiders bothered to notice. Ansfield, surveying the borough's devastation, deems it the core of 20th century racial capitalism. One might alternatively see it as capitalism's no man's land. Rather than being central to the system, the Bronx hardly mattered to it at all. Something that's worse. In July 1977, near the arson wave's peak, the power to New York City cut out. The city had endured a blackout before, in 1965, a largely benign event memorialized in the flirty Doris Day comedy, Where Were You When the Lights Went Out? This time, however, New York exploded. More than 1,000 fires burned and more than 1,000 shops were ransacked. Crowds emptied the South Bronx furniture stores where Vivian Vasquez, Irazi's father, worked. It shut down and he lost his job of 17 years. Poor people have been waiting years for those lights to go out, one woman explained. Musicians treating the power outage as an impromptu arts grant stole mixers and turntables. That sprung a whole new set of DJs, the hip-hop pioneer Grandmaster Caz recalled. Others took baby food and diapers. The blackout exposed both the depth of people's needs and the depth of their rage. It was a collective reckoning, Ansfield writes. The South Bronx burned, and landlords were, for once, probably not the main culprits. 3 months later, President Jimmy Carter arrived to survey the debris. The blackout, Carter's visit, and the 1977 World Series turned the South Bronx into the country's most famous slum. Paul Newman starred in the blockbuster movie Fort Apache, The Bronx. Ted Kennedy, Ronald Reagan, Pope John Paul II, and Mother Teresa made pilgrimages. The South Bronx was as crucial to the understanding U.S. cities, the Times declared, as Auschwitz was to understanding Nazism. The negative attention pushed the authorities to act. Perverse incentives in insurance and welfare policies were removed. Insurers, alerted to the problem and granted permission to respond, grew more discriminating in their underwriting and more probing in their investigations. Fire marshals and police investigations became conspicuous presence in arson zones. The arson strike force tried outreach to deter kids from setting fires, straying from its anti-landlord mission into radicalized paradigm of juvenile delinquency, Ansfield grumbles. It also identified arson-prone buildings and put their owners on notice. Better, Ansfield feels, though still far from mounting a confrontation with the property regime. Whatever their shortfalls, such measures appeared to work. The number of intentionally set fires in New York City buildings dropped by nearly two-thirds from 1976 to 1984. This was a triumph, but also an indictment. Arson was fixable. How had it gone unfixed for so long? As the city recovered its budget, it poured vast sums into urban rehabilitation, especially in the Bronx. Suddenly, tenants' groups got resources. By 1984, with help from Genevieve Brooks' organization, families were moving into ranch houses on the former rubble field where Carter had once stood, wildflowers blooming in the burn scar. The devastation Carter had witnessed arose from abandonment. The population rebounded soon afterward, though. And now parts of the South Bronx face the opposite phenomena, gentrification. Ansfield describes a lavish party thrown in 2015 to promote a residential and retail complex on the Harlem River, which cost hundreds of millions to build. Celebrities like Kendall Jenner, Adrian Brody, and Naomi Campbell, along with leading New York politicians, drank Dom Perignon amid loose bricks, fires burning in trash cans, and a sculpture made from bullet-riddled cars. Rune porn is the name for this fetishizing of urban decay. Guests posted photos tagging hashtag the Bronx is burning. You're listening to the New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Too soon, the memories of smoke-filled hallways, of desperate searches for family members remain vivid. For more than a decade, economic forces, large and small, lit harrowing fires. These burned in the most populous city in the U.S., matched by others throughout the country, yet barely registered as news. Was all this, as Anfield suggests, what capitalism required? In a way, that's a consoling thought. The more dispiriting alternative is that it needn't have happened at all, and that the Bronx burned-out homes were monuments not just to greed, but to indifference. Daniel Immerwahr is a contributing writer at The New Yorker, teaches history at Northwestern University, and is the author of How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. Annals of Inquiry, The Family Fallout of DNA Surprises. Through genetic testing, millions of Americans are estimated to have discovered that their parents aren't who they thought. The news has upended relationships and created a community looking for answers. By Jennifer Wilson. Lily Wood was 43 years old, but considers April 9, 2019 to be her rebirth day. That was the date she received her results from Ancestry, the direct-to-consumer DNA testing company. A self-described biohacker, Wood had been curious to see whether she had a genetic predisposition to diseases like Alzheimer's. "I wanted to get ahead of things," she told me. It was actually her second time testing. The first time, Wood had used 23andMe, but the results had seemed off to her. The ethnicity was wrong, she said before correcting herself. "I thought it was wrong. Her heritage, as she'd always understood it, was French on her father's side and Norwegian on her mother's." And yet the 23andMe customers who had come up as genetically close matches had Italian names. Wood, who lives in Minneapolis, where she grew up, called her sister, who speculated that a strand of hair belonging to a lab technician had gotten into the vial. Her sister advised her to try Ancestry. When the new results came in, Wood learned that there was a man in the company's database with whom she shared 1,400 centimorgans, a measure of genetic overlap that typically denotes a half-sibling. But this man was a stranger to her, and the site said that he had Sicilian ancestry. Wood drove to her mother's house a few miles away. When she arrived, her mother, Vicky, was sitting at the kitchen table with her husband, Wood's stepfather. At the mention of the close match's surname, Vicky's face turned bright red. She replied that it was the name of her old boss at FedEx. Wood was nonplussed. "I was like, what are you saying right now? Are you, what?" she recalled. Wood's stepfather looked at his wife and said, "You never thought this was going to come back and bite you, did you?" Vicky then filled in a few details. She had gotten pregnant after sleeping with a higher-up on a business trip in Memphis while married to her first husband, Wood's presumed father. The next week was emotionally confusing for Wood. Money had been tight when she was growing up. The man she now called her birth certificate father had driven a cab, and she'd swept the floors at a local private school in exchange for tuition. Suddenly, here she was, Googling her biological father, a longtime executive at the shipping company, and finding pictures of what appeared to be him and his children riding horses at their ranch in Wyoming. She felt like her world was shattering, she told me, but no one around her registered the news that way. She remembered being asked in the family group chat what side dish she was bringing for Easter dinner. "We're a sweep-it-under-the-rug sort of family," she said. But as Wood saw it, this wasn't exactly her family anymore. She confronted her mother, telling her that she did not seem very remorseful. Her sister thought her mother might interpret this as sex-shaming. Wood protested. "I don't care who she slept with, or if the marriage was closed, open, whatever," she said. "This isn't about sex. This is about the lie." Wood tracked down her biological father and introduced herself. His initial response was encouraging. He said that he remembered her mother. "We will help bring clarity to this," he assured her, and told her he'd be in touch soon. A week later, she heard from him again, but the tone had shifted. By then, she had reached out to the man Ancestry had indicated was a half-sibling. Her biological father chastised her. His words were like, "We don't do shock and awe in my family," as if I'm like Jerry Springer, Maury Povich person. But Wood did ultimately get into the paternity surprise media business. 6 weeks after her rebirth day, she purchased a mic and, using her living room as a studio, launched a podcast devoted to interviews with people who, like her, had found out through commercial DNA testing that they had been misinformed about their biological parentage. Wood named her podcast NPE Stories. The term NPE is often credited to a 2000 study conducted by a pair of geneticists at Oxford who examined whether male Britons with the last name Sykes could be traced to a single shared ancestor through their Y chromosomes. But they kept coming across two men named Sykes who didn't even share their father's Y chromosome. They called these subjects diplomatically non-paternity events. In 2017, the acronym became a more entrenched online community when a woman named Catherine St. Clair created a Facebook group, eventually called NPE, Fellowship, for people who had discovered misattributed parentage through commercial DNA tests. She rebranded NPE to stand for the less technical, not parent expected, and welcome late discovery adoptees, LDAs, and donor-conceived persons, DCPs, to join the family fray. When Wood started her show, there was already a podcast of NPEs, tell-alls, called Cut Off Genes. Soon came others, Everything's Relative, Family Twist, Sex, Lies, and the Truth. Before long, anyone with a Spotify account could listen to hundreds of hours of adults trying to make sense of their parents' sex lives. Episodes about people who found out that their parents had been swingers in the 70s practically formed their own subgenre. A man named Jonathan told the hosts of Sex, Lies, and the Truth that after being contacted by a daughter he never knew he had, he was upset with her mother at first, but then he reflected that 30 years earlier he had been a weed-smoking hippie while she had also been involved with a man training to be an engineer. "In that race, I was Seabiscuit," he said. Not all episodes are so convivial. Many NPEs look back on their childhoods and, cataloging every slight, every time they felt different, wonder, was that why? Paternity has historically been tricky to pin down. Mommy's baby, daddy's maybe, as the saying goes. But now the milkman's kid can buy a DNA test from Target. Occasionally, people learn that their mother used an egg donor, but paternity surprises are more common. Since the first commercial DNA test debuted in 2000, the market has exploded. A 2025 YouGov poll found that 1 in 5 Americans has taken a direct-to-consumer DNA test. A few years ago, a research team at Baylor College of Medicine surveyed more than 20,000 customers of these kits and learned that 3% of them had discovered that a person whom they believed to be their biological parent wasn't. That number is in line with a 2005 study from a university in Liverpool, which found a 3.7% median rate of misattributed paternity in the general population. If the ratio holds, that means around 2 million Americans who have taken one of these tests are NPEs. A cottage industry has sprung up to service them. There are therapists who specialize in treating NPEs and DNA detectives who can track down relatives who haven't taken tests by triangulating the results of those who have. There are coaches who guide parents in breaking the news about their child's origins. Brianne Kirkpatrick-Williams of Watershed DNA is a genetic counselor who advises on her website that she spent years delivering bad news to expectant parents, which makes her uniquely qualified to aid clients who want to inform their grown children that they were donor-conceived, say, or to let their spouses know that they were contacted by a previously unknown biological child. She charges $899 for a 4-session prepare-to-share package. I became interested in doing a story on NPEs after a friend's ex-boyfriend found out in his 30s that he was one. Hunter, not his real name, was a state-level politician who ran a campaign on his working-class roots, only to find out that his mother had had an affair with a well-off scientist. Hunter had known his biological father his whole life as a family friend. Sometimes this man dropped off hand-me-downs that his sons, Hunter's half-brothers, had outgrown. Hunter told me that he had joined Facebook groups devoted to NPEs, but promptly left them. It was too much, he said. It turns out that anger at your mother and a hobbyist understanding of genetics is a potent and potentially politicized combination. Some factions are trying to transform NPEs from an identity group to an interest one. A guest on Wood's podcast, for example, an NPE named Richard, who is a clinician by profession, argued that people could be entitled to sue their mother for keeping the identity of their father's secret on the grounds of parental alienation. Severance, a magazine that covers NPEs, was launched in 2019 by a Pennsylvanian writer named B.K. Jackson. It takes its name from a belief that NPEs have been severed from their biological families. Alongside extramarital affairs, the magazine lists adoptions, kidnapping, undisclosed step-parent adoption, paternity fraud, donor-assisted conception, and non-consensual sex as causes of severance. Such rhetoric, which places gamete donations next to criminal acts, has alarmed many in the LGBTQ community, as has the legal advocacy works of a Seattle-based organization founded by an NPE called Right to Know. The group wants to mandate the inclusion of donor and surrogate names on birth certificates, which currently reflect legal, not genetic, parentage. Some in the LGBTQ community fear that this will, by default, force them to report more information than opposite-sex couples are required to. In making its case, Right to Know can at times rely on nascent, controversial theories within the world of genomics, which many scientists caution overstates the impact of genes on our health and personalities. In myth, if a hero wants to achieve greatness, to slay a multi-headed hydra, to part the Red Sea, to bring balance to the Force, he is almost required to have a dramatic paternity reveal. But now millions of mere mortals are having to contend with the same epic dilemmas. What's the appropriate amount of anger over an extramarital affair? Will our roots always tug at us, even if we don't know they're ours? Who or what exactly determines our destiny? In 1999, the producers of Maury came to their host, Maury Povich, with an idea to boost ratings. These soap operas, they take 6 months to reveal someone's secret father, Povich remembered them saying. We can do that in 15 minutes on air. The show became known for its flamboyant paternity test results, reveals, and for men suddenly off the hook for child support, doing celebratory dances. Povich told me, people come up to me all the time on the street. They like to grab their pregnant wife and get me to say, you are the father. His show was controversial. Scholars have accused it of reinforcing stereotypes about black women's promiscuity, but nevertheless, it became a cultural touchstone. In a 2015 Saturday Night Live Weekend Update segment about Black History Month, Michael Che joked about Povich, he set more black men free than Abraham Lincoln. Povich's show was also an unlikely educational resource. In the 90s, DNA was the stuff of science fiction. I first heard about it in Jurassic Park, but here it was something real with real-life consequences. The scholar Nara B. Melnick, in her book Paternity, the Elusive Quest for the Father, observes that in the past, biological paternity was considered an ineffable enigma of nature, not just unknown, but indeed unknowable. For much of the 20th century, the closest thing to a paternity test was the ABO blood type test, invented in 1924 by a German doctor named Fritz Schiff. But that test could only exclude a possible father, not positively identify one. Then in 1984, a British geneticist named Alex Jeffries discovered DNA fingerprinting, which allowed scientists to take a sample of hair, skin, or saliva and single out a sequence of nucleotides specific to one person. But such testing was intended for professionals in a lab. That all changed when a retired business owner in Texas had some extra time on his hands. People had always asked Bennett Greenspan whether he was related to the economist Alan Greenspan. "I had no answer," he said. He had never met Alan Greenspan and had never heard that he was a distant relation. Most of us in his position would simply have replied no, but Greenspan, now 73, had been fascinated by genealogy since he was a kid. He once brought an empty chart to a shiva, where he mined his elderly Eastern European relatives for intel. He always felt that there were paper trail roadblocks stopping him from getting a full picture of his family tree. In 1997, Greenspan read an article in the Times about a group of geneticists who had tested the Y chromosomes of Jewish men who believed themselves to be part of an ancient priestly tradition called the Kohanim. He called Michael Hammer, one of the researchers quoted in the story, and ran a lab at the University of Arizona and asked to buy a DNA test. Greenspan figured that if science could try to trace Jewish men alive today to Aaron and Mount Sinai, there might be hope for his family tree. Hammer told him that his DNA tests were for anthropological purposes only. Greenspan countered with a technique he had learned from sales, which was to let an awkward silence emerge. Hammer fell for it, interjecting, "Someone should start a company for this, because I get calls from crazy genealogists like you all the time." Hammer and the University of Arizona agreed to let Greenspan run direct-to-consumer tests out of their lab for a fee, and in 2000, Family Tree DNA, the first home DNA testing kit, was born. Greenspan remembered getting calls from confused customers. These brothers called, and they go, "We think your test is wrong. We two match, but our little brother doesn't." I said, "Come on." In 2006, a new kind of DNA test came on the market. Co-founded by Ann Wojcicki, a biotech analyst, 23andMe used autosomal DNA, which could better trace recent relatives on both the patrilineal and the matrilineal lines. Wojcicki envisioned 23andMe as a healthcare startup. Your saliva could reveal your odds of getting early-onset dementia or determine if your earwax was sticky because of a C variant in the ABCC11 gene. In 2008, 23andMe hosted a celebrity spit party at New York Fashion Week. Wojcicki told a reporter from the Times that Barry Diller was unable to roll his tongue, whereas his fellow guest Anderson Cooper could make a four-leaf clover with his. Another DNA testing company also decided to start leveraging the power of celebrity. Back in 2003, Rick Kittles, then a geneticist at Howard University, co-founded African Ancestry, a direct-to-consumer DNA test marketed to African Americans. He began contacting high-profile black figures and offering to test them. The Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. recalled hearing from Kittles, "I get a letter saying, 'Dear Dr. Gates, have you seen Roots?' Gates told me, and I was thinking, what kind of idiot does this guy think I am? Everybody's seen Roots." Kittles thought that someone else had connected him to Gates and doesn't remember the letter, but in any case, the men teamed up and Gates hosted two seasons of a PBS show called African American Lives, DNA testing famous black people such as Oprah Winfrey, Quincy Jones, and Maya Angelou. In 2012, the premise was expanded to include all backgrounds, and the show became Finding Your Roots. The first time Gates got an MPE case, he told me, was ahead of an episode featuring LL Cool J. The genetic genealogist he worked with on the show, Cece Moore, called Gates to tell him she had discovered that the rapper's mother was adopted. "I almost dropped the telephone because this was not my playbook," Gates remarked. "I was just trying to get black people their Kunta Kinte moment." Then, just as the actress Kerry Washington was considering appearing on the show, her parents called Gates. According to Washington's memoir, Thicker Than Water, her mother asked him, "If Kerry had been conceived in a way that was not biologically related to her father, would that kind of thing come up in a DNA test?" it turned out that they had used a sperm donor to conceive her. The involvement of Gates, a prominent black professor, quieted some concerns about the use of DNA to determine heritage. The field of genetics, after all, has an ugly history. The Nazis used paternity testing to look for Jews hidden in Aryan genealogies, as Nara B. Milanich writes. But now it was not only socially acceptable to take a DNA test, it was sometimes pitched as a form of racial justice. Kittles told me that the actor Isaiah Washington had founded a hospital in Sierra Leone after his African ancestry test revealed roots there. I myself was given a test as thanks for speaking to a group of minority students about graduate school. We don't have an honorarium, but we have an ancestry DNA test for you, the vice provost joked, handing me a small box. I've never been drawn to the idea of doing one personally, but something Gates said made me understand the seductions of DNA, particularly for people who've been deprived of some part of their family story. Our ancestors are dead in one sense, but they're very alive in the shaping of your identity, your phenotype, the color of your hair, the color of your eyes, medical traits, Gates told me. It's a kind of immortality that we didn't learn about in church. Earlier this summer, I rang the bell of a brownstone on the Upper West Side. I was there to meet Michelle Grethel, a psychotherapist, at her private office. Among the specialties listed on her website is identity exploration, e.g. LGBTQIA, transgender, non-binary, and unexpected DNA discoveries. To try to understand that range, I asked Grethel what the subject of her dissertation had been. She told me that she had written about gender dysphoria in 18 to 25-year-olds who were assigned female at birth and were in the process of transitioning. She wanted to help people, she said, who were coming into a more authentic sense of themselves. Now, Grethel leads a team of researchers who have surveyed hundreds of NPEs about their experiences. As she sees it, they too are stepping into their true identity. She has observed that the MPEs who tend to take the news hardest are the ones who had a difficult parental relationship. That was true of the Prozac Nation author Elizabeth Wurzel, who at the age of 50 learned that her biological father was the photographer Bob Adelman, not her mother's husband, Donald Wurzel, with whom she'd had a complicated dynamic. I have been working out that relationship all of my life in writing and therapy and conversation with cocaine and heroin, she wrote in an essay for The Cut. I have perfected a two-handed backhand to clobber the lob that is coming at me that is the wrong problem. I have aced the wrong problem. Sigmund Freud in Family Romances writes that all of us, once we realize as children the uncertainty of paternity, began fantasizing about alternative fathers. In my fantasy, my father owned a gumball machine empire, and I was an heiress with bad teeth. But Grethel pointed out that the desire for a perfect do-over with a new parent can lead to profound disappointment. In 2012, the Canadian actress and director Sarah Polley learned that her biological father was the film producer Harry Gulkin, a discovery she documented in the film Stories We Tell. There was this honeymoon period, Polly told me, of the year after she reconnected with Gulkin. It was exciting, like, wow, what a twist. But then it became quite tumultuous. Michael Slepian, a psychologist at Columbia University, researches the toll of keeping secrets. For his book, The Secret Life of Secrets, How Our Inner World Shape Well-Being, Relationships, and Who We Are, Slepian asked research participants, half of whom were told to imagine themselves as having a small secret, the other half a big one, to estimate the height of a grassy hill. The latter group thought the incline was sharper than the former group did. Slepian deduced that people who say they feel weighted down by a secret do in fact feel burdened in other parts of their lives as well. The night after Slepian first presented his findings at Columbia, he got a frantic call from his father. He and his mother had realized that they, like his subjects, had been suffering under the weight of a secret. Slepian had been conceived through a sperm donor, his father confessed over the phone. Many people assume it was the other way around, Slepian told me, that I researched secrets because my family had been keeping one. But no, my research helped them unburden themselves. Slepian also studies the moral calculus of divulging a secret, like, for example, when and whether to reveal to a partner that you were unfaithful. He thinks that, in the context of NPEs, technology has altered the question of disclosure. I know folks who wish they'd learn this from their parents rather than a website. The treatment of NPEs is a growth market within the therapy sector, giving rise to NPE trauma recovery coaches and identity reinvention facilitators. Some interventions can seem more improvised than others. Lily Wood mentioned that she had been using eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, to help her reckon with her discovery. This method typically involves having patients focus on a specific traumatic event. I asked Wood whether hers was the day she got the result. No, she said, her therapist had been doing point of conception EMDR. She's like, I don't do this very often, but we're going to go back to the moment you were in utero. Babies feel everything, even as a fetus. Wood was a little dubious herself. I'm only on the third trimester, so I don't know if it's working yet, she said. And that's all we have time for today. Jennifer Wilson is a staff writer at The New Yorker covering books and culture. In 2024, she received a Robert B. Silvers Prize for Literary Criticism. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.